Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Well, it's official. We now have the longest government shutdown in our country's history on the books. So we're going to go in depth on this lingering government shutdown. When we started it back in December, around the 22nd, I think, it was the 21st time that we've been through this. But it's not since the epic battle between Clinton and Gingrich back in 95-96 that we had a government shutdown lasting this long. We are now at 31 days. With me to talk about how we got into this mess and how we might dig ourselves out are Jeffrey Engel, director for the Center of Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Welcome, Dr. Engel.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Can I call you Jeff?
Yeah, please do.
All right, great. And Linda Bilmes, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
And of course, this conversation only gets better with you. Are you a federal worker who's been furloughed? Do you remember the Clinton-Gingrich shutdown or Carter or Reagan? Do you have a solution for getting us out of this current hot mess that we're in? You can call me 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. And you can find me on Twitter at Tiffany Hansen with two S's E-N. And I should add, we're not here to debate the wall. We're here to talk a little bit about history and the economic effects of the shutdown and how we might come to a solution. Jeff, I want to start with you. This is not our first rodeo, right? We've had, the second longest, I guess, is Clinton-Gingrich. They ended up coming to an agreement. How'd they do that?
You know, basically, the Republicans caved on all the major issues. That was a broad-based shutdown, the long one in 1995-96, over Medicare, over different types of welfare spending. And the Republicans, of course, had taken back the House in 1994. This was Newt Gingrich's famous contract with America agenda. Mm-hmm. And essentially, after 2 years of being in office, or excuse me, a year and a half of being in office at that point, the country had grown a little bit weary of the contract. That is to say, the country was more interested in the programs that Bill Clinton was offering. And I think in large part because Clinton did something that Donald Trump has not, in that Clinton did the normal thing for a president after getting trounced in the midterms. He was trounced in 94, which is to say that he tacked back to the center. He tried to become more of a moderate, if you will, and more of a compromiser. And therefore, the public, I think, which generally appreciates the center, the public in a dispute between right and left saw him as the compromiser and the Republicans as the obstinate party. And essentially, they were forced to give in.
Well, it wasn't without some crazy antics, though, right? I mean, I read something about Gingrich being forced off Air Force One, and he was all crabby about that. And
well, you know, one of the problems with exploring macro history with personalities is that all these people have big personalities, and sometimes the little things do matter. So there is a story out there. I think there's a tad bit of truth to it, but it's not the major issue, that Newt Gingrich was actually a little bit miffed at his seating on Air Force One when he joined the president to go to, I believe it was Yitzhak Rabin's funeral in Israel. Apparently, the Speaker of the House did not appreciate how far back in the plane he was. And it was at that moment, the story goes, that he said, well, in that case, we'll shut it all down. I don't actually buy that. I think that might have been the moment that frustration boiled mm-hmm. over, much like mm-hmm. President Trump the other day saying, mm-hmm. I will own this shutdown. Mm-hmm. Sometimes words come out of our mouths that are exemplify our emotions. But the big issue had to be there already. There had to already be a partisan divide before something as minuscule as peanuts or a seat on an airplane could have effect.
Well, could we say is it accurate to say that shutdowns used to be about more mundane government issues, more operational type things, expenditures? I'm thinking back to, you know, Carter, well, Reagan. I mean, is that accurate?
I would put this one in the middle, in a sense that we have had many shutdowns, in particular during the Reagan years, which were essentially shutdowns for an afternoon or for a weekend or for a day, which essentially were over, as you said, one or two small issues in the budget that the government was disputing and the president did not appreciate in the budget or want in the budget. Subsequently, in George H.W. Bush's tenure, there was a more significant furlough policy-wise. It only lasted a weekend, but the policy, again, involved Newt Gingrich in that he, as representing the right wing of the Republican congressional legislation, essentially refused to back President Bush when he went back on his no new taxes pledge. Mm. The budget deal of 1990 included rising taxes. President Bush determined that there was no way to get a budget without that. And frankly, his economists told him that raising taxes would actually be a good idea for the economy. And the subsequent growth of the 90s, I think, proved them right. And that shutdown was essentially over the question of whether or not we should have higher taxes or not. So again, that was a policy issue. So the debate we're seeing today is, I think, over a policy issue, but we've managed to remove most of the policy discussion from it. I mean, the real debate that we're having is over what the nature of American immigration should be, and in a broader sense, what the nature of American identity should be. And we've managed to whittle it down to concrete or steel in the desert as the not just a symbol, but the living emblem of what side you're on the issue. If we could stop talking about the wall and start talking more about immigration, that would actually be more like the cases in the past that have proven to find successful compromises.
Linda, you worked under Clinton, am I right? You were
yes.
Yes, you were in his Department of Commerce, right?
Yes, I was Assistant Secretary of Commerce.
Do you remember shutdowns? How it went down? You have any recollections that would be helpful as we're looking at this current shutdown from how that actually concluded with a 7-year budget plan?
Well, I think that it's tempting to view the current shutdown as just another temper tantrum by the current president. But when we think about it in retrospect, there have been so many shutdowns, and they've taken place under Presidents Ford, Carter, Reagan, W.H. Bush, you know, Clinton and Obama. And we really should be looking at the root cause of these shutdowns, which is the collapse of the federal budget process since 1974. And since in those last 45 years, I mean, including in the Clinton years and so forth, Congress has only managed to pass its spending bills on time in 4 years out of 45 years. So instead what has happened is that we have had a increasing volume of short-term stopgap funding measures, as well as continual fiscal crises and debt ceiling crises and sequestration and fiscal cliffs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And until that underlying problem with the budget process having collapsed is fixed, we're going to continue having shutdowns.
Well, this leads to the claims of if the rest of the world worked that way, we'd be fired.
As a taxpayer, you know, feel like we can't just say because we don't like something that we're not going to pay taxes or as an employee that we're going to quit or shut down or not work over everything we disagree with. But in terms of the shutdown, of course, there is a very significant economic cost to the government not being able to keep the government open, particularly the longer it goes on.
This is NPR News. I'm Tiffany Hansen in for Carrie Miller. And we're talking about the government shutdown. It's now at 31 days. With me are Jeffrey Engel from the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University and Linda Bilmes, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School. I want to go to Duane in Lauderdale here before we get back into the conversation, Jeff and Linda. Duane, you are a federal employee. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. I've worked for the federal government for 35 years.
Great. And you've dealt with Clinton and Obama?
Right. And now this one.
Okay.
I'm furloughed for this shutdown also.
And what are your big concerns right now? Of course, other than I'm assuming your paycheck.
Well, it's just the morale of the fellow employees when we get back to work. Also, trying to get back to work. You know, will we be able to get on the different computer systems that we need to get on to do our job? Generally, after 30 days, we get locked out. So, you know, we're. So it's going to take us a few days just to get on and then just get back doing what we should be doing. Just that time delay and all the things that should be done that isn't being done because we're not there.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So, Jeff, I wonder if that was a consideration for Clinton Gingrich because they had the, you know, second longest in history. Were they thinking about how this was going to affect the return to work? Yeah.
Well, this was certainly among the longer shutdowns that had ever occurred at that point. So there was a shall we say, a little bit more hysteria over the idea that the government was shut down. And it was also a bigger shutdown across the government than the one we're seeing today. The truth is, as my colleague mentioned just a moment ago, you know, we are seeing this process play out and we are seeing more and more shutdowns. And so in a sense, the public is becoming more and more used to it. Now, of course, that's going to diminish in our astonishment should increase as we see this shutdown become now the longest in history and we see the effects on it, on the economy and on the furloughed workers. But in a real sense, the shutdowns that we had in the 90s were more dramatic because people found them more traumatic. At this point now, it's the longevity that really seems to be bothering the American public.
Mm-hmm. Linda, I want to talk about that. Basically, back in 1974, there was something called the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act. And that was, if I'm correct, the sort of turning point for this whole shutdown phenomenon that we've been experiencing since then. It was a shift in budgeting power, am I right here, from the executive branch to the legislative branch? Because up to that point, am I right here?
Yes. So from 1921 to 1974, there was one law that governed the budget process, and it gave more power to the president and the executive branch. And in 1974, after Vietnam and after the Watergate fiasco, Congress essentially took back some of the power over budgeting. But that process, the 1974 process that was intended really to strengthen congressional control over the budget, has broken down. And pretty much every budget expert agrees that it's not working. But, you know, I wanted to make sure that I get back, that we get back to some of the costs of this shutdown.
Sure. Yep.
Because, I mean, government spending has ripple effects across the whole economy. So if the government is not spending money, the whole economy is hurting. And the president's own Council of Economic Advisers have already indicated that there's been a fairly significant hit to the first quarter growth.
Well, they revised their numbers upward, right? So we're at 0.4% of GDP per month.
Well, I think we're now we have a sort of a weekly hit. We're at about you know, 0.5% of off growth for this quarter.
Okay.
And of course, we're already under pressure from a slowdown in the global economy and the volatility in the stock market. So this is you know, a really terrible time to be adding another blow to the economy. But this shutdown in particular is affecting not only the shutdowns always have a major regional effect, especially around Virginia and Maryland, where you have a lot of federal employees. But this one is also really impacting states like Wyoming, Montana, mm-hmm. Alaska, Maine, rural places, because the Department of Interior and the Department of Agriculture, which have a very significant presence in those states, are shut down.
So there's a twofold problem here. We have individuals and families who are struggling, and then we have all of the related businesses and surrounding companies that are also going to be affected by this. I mean, we know that most Americans don't have what they need in savings, you know, for something that's going to cost them, let's say, $1,000. So when we have a big percentage of these folks, I think the Washington Post said something around 100,000 of them making less than $50,000 a year, we're talking real crisis when we get to Friday and it's the second paycheck they haven't had.
Yes, I mean, there's a very significant impact, I mean, both to the several hundred thousand federal workers who are now being asked either to stay home and get paid for not working or to work for free, essentially. And I think that it's one thing to ask people to do that for a couple of days. It's terrible, but it's now getting to the point where it's becoming very dangerous. Many, many activities, you know, being performed, you know, food and water inspections and state and local programs that are funded by the federal government and Coast Guard inspections are not happening. You know, as I think about it, I mean, I could leave my cat home alone for a day, but not for a month. You know, I mean, and the whole government is now seizing up, as your caller Duane was saying, so that people's work is not getting done. And all of that work is not being done, as well as the fact that for every government employee effective, you have at least two federal contractors who are involved in everything from food inspection to cancer research. And they are in even worse shape in many cases than government employees.
Can I jump in here?
Sure,
with the broad picture. I mean, I think it's brilliant that we're having this discussion about the consequences. But we have to remember as well that this is part of a longer trend in American political history. You know, beginning essentially in the 1980s, the discussion among the conservative movement changed from we need a smaller government to in some ways we need no government. I mean, ironically, the person who first advocated that in many ways was Ronald Reagan, who actually grew the government under his administration. But the idea that the world would function if we had less and less government and no government is something that's actually very popular on the right. And I think it's going to be fascinating over the next few months as this continues, where people are starting to realize that, oh, my goodness, the federal government actually does do something I need. You know, it is impossible. It's quite wonderful to say we don't need the government when it's functioning wonderfully and you don't see it, when you don't see the food inspections, when you don't see the air traffic controllers, when there's nothing going wrong because the system's going right. People don't have a sense that they require any need. And I think we're going to see a real pushback from the American people who have paid their taxes and, frankly, want the system to work as efficiently as they didn't realize it was working.
And if you are a federal worker, I would love to hear from you, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Let me know how this long shutdown is affecting your pocketbook, your morale, how you're looking at your job. Are you looking for a new job? We'd love to hear from you. And Jeff, talking about the historical ramifications, I guess, I'm not sure. Are we talking also about a wage gap issue here when we have wealthy members of Congress who are trying desperately not to look cavalier about the loss to families and not so much of, I mean, everybody remembers the pictures of Nancy Pelosi on the beach in Hawaii with folks that are really, really struggling. And is it an indication of a wage gap issue?
Yeah, I think this is one of the reasons.
I mean, I don't want to derail us too far, but I feel it's worth mentioning.
No, but the political solution that's going to arise in the end is going to be one that's based in large part upon public whim and public perception. And it's, as you pointed out, there is, of course, a natural sense among the electorate that Congress is unpopular and Congress is certainly removed from the day-to-day needs of the average American. But I think it's fascinating that we have a president now who has made his entire persona, his entire image, based upon his vast wealth. And therefore, he, I think, is particularly unsuited to ask people who are at the lower end of the pay scale, the lowest end of the federal pay scale, in fact, to go without pay. I think he's going to be a terrible messenger of that, and I think that's going to put particular pressure on him. I mean, one of the things that's important to go back to the 95 shutdown as an example is that Bill Clinton not only managed to have the public perceive that the shutdown was his opponent's fault, he also managed to, at the same time, explain to the American people that he was fighting, or have the American people believe that he was fighting for issues that they cared about, fighting for day-to-day issues. In a sense, he was not only the victim, if you will, in the shutdown, but he was also on their side. I think it's going to be very difficult for Donald Trump to continue to make the argument that he is on the side of the federal workers when, frankly, he has made his entire political career, short though it is, out of essentially saying that I am above the fray economically.
Well, Clinton's numbers actually went up, didn't they?
Yeah, in fact, you know, you really can point to the shutdown as sort of the first step in Clinton's remaking himself for the 96 mm-hmm. election. You know, in 94, to go back, in his first midterm in office, he was trounced, and this allowed the Republicans to take control of the Congress for the first time in the House for the first time in decades. And it really allowed him to essentially repivot and rethink his positions and pivot back to the middle, and really helped him win the solid victory in 1996. So this is a wonderful political moment, if you will, for the president to relaunch his reelection campaign should he choose. But at the moment, he seems to be in a position of having to watch his popularity decrease rather than increase if we believe recent polls.
Linda, these are quote-unquote normal people that we're talking about that are affected by this. Now, not everybody knows a federal worker. In the same way, I think you could draw a parallel a little bit between the same way we talk about how not everyone knows someone in the military and feels that most directly when we send our military abroad into harm's way. In the same way, we don't understand, do we, the pain of these folks, because not all of us know someone who works in the federal government. We're happy that the IRS isn't working. But it does... it does still affect public opinion.
Well, I've co-written a book, The People Factor, which is about the federal civil service. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this issue. And I think it's just absolutely appalling the way we are treating the federal workforce. It is when you study leading companies across the world, virtually every leading company in the world treats its workforce as a precious asset. They're very aware that their assets walk home every night. And we are treating our workforce like pawns in a political game of chess, with all of this game of chicken between Congress and the president. And this is, of course, the 22nd time this has happened, but this time it's gone on and on. And I think it's appalling, and it affects not only the morale of the current federal workforce, but I teach at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, where I'm teaching the next generation of the public sector workforce. And my students are saying, why should we work for the federal government? If we want to work for government, maybe we'll work for local government. They're looking at this with absolute dismay and disgust.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, and again, I think there's a broader historical narrative here that I think we need to keep in the back of our minds, maybe even move to the front of our minds, that, you know, essentially since the 1970s, since Vietnam, the country has really done a dramatic shift on how it perceives public service, to the point where after more than a decade of war since 9/11, you really only get the sense from the American public that military service is the only public service that's valued. I mean, we're supposed to walk up to military people in uniform at the airport and say thank you for your service and buy them a hamburger. When's the last time someone told you to do that for a federal food inspector or for someone who works for the National Park Service? And we've really managed to whittle down effective, useful, the most important public service to those who are carrying arms or working in the military and disregarding the rest. And I think that there's a real sense in which the American public does not value the work of federal workers because they have not been told for the last generation that is a critical form of public service.
Well, our time is evaporating, unfortunately, and we don't have a solution yet. But I do want to take a comment here from Thor in Glencoe. Welcome, Thor. You there?
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, you had an interesting idea.
Yeah, so I find myself wondering that we might not be better off as a nation if we introduce legislation once the government's been reopened to, one, prevent legislators from leaving Washington until there's been a clean fiscal year budget passed, and then, two, also pass legislation that prevents any other bills being brought to the floor until there's been a budget passed for a full fiscal year. Would that not be better?
Linda, is that even possible?
Well, I think that Thor is on the right track. I think that there have been bipartisan efforts to introduce bills such as No Budget, No Pay. And I think that Thor is on the right track, that this needs to be treated as a national emergency and that this needs to be prevented at all costs. And we need to get to the root cause of this issue and revamp the budget process so we don't use shutdowns, which, in my opinion, are like medieval duels. They're stupid and immature.
Well, it's a politicking tool at this point, right, Jeff?
It is, and as my colleague said, this is a dueling way to essentially have the public think that there's a winner and a loser in this battle. And I think that's very critical to appreciate that right now the calculations that are going on in both the White House and in the congressional chambers is not only about what's best for the country, but what's best about each actor's political future. And I think the American people are actually very smart about this, that they will essentially recognize which actor has the country's interest at heart and which is only acting for their own political interest. That seems to be the historical lesson. When the public perceives one player of the duel as dueling for them, then they are much more likely to put pressure on the opponent to cave, if you will. And right now, if President Trump continues to discuss this issue as part of his reelection campaign, concerned about his base or concerned about how he's going to frame himself, having perhaps gone back on one of his central campaign promises, if he continues to think about this in terms of his own presidential campaign, that's something that I think ultimately will cause erosion of his support.
So we're talking about whose reputation is going to be damaged less.
Yeah, these are reputation-building moments. I mean, these are the moments that we are going to that we look back to, and it's fascinating to see at the same time that we're seeing Democrats jump into the race, you know, faster and faster, if you will, you know, earlier and earlier. There's a real sense, I think, in which this is the opening salvo of the 2020 election.
Go ahead, Linda. Did you want to add something?
Yeah. I mean, I want to agree with what Jeff is saying, that I think the public really sees that this is a kind of a duel. The public thinks that it's immature, and the public will ultimately reward the party that is the bigger person. So in this case, I mean, I think that the president has already blinked, and the Democrats need to get this thing finished, even if that means making some concessions, because it's not just the federal workforce, although they are absolutely carrying the water. It's not just the federal contractors, although they are, but the entire economy can go into a tailspin if we don't get the government reopened.
Linda, one last question. Are there economic consequences from this that will be irreversible, something that we can't recover from?
Well, I think it's hard to know how long the economic consequences will be felt. But there are certainly a number of hidden costs. I mean, for example, you know, most businesses in the country rely on federal data on housing and manufacturing and labor. I mean, none of that is being produced. The safety of the country relies on many Coast Guard inspections, which are not being carried out because the Coast Guard is operating on a shoestring. If we have a major national security event because inspections are not being carried out on food or water or cargo coming into our ports, I mean, that could have a very significant impact overall that lasts for a long time.
Well, thank you so much for your insight. I think it's been helpful to have a little historical context here and talk a little bit about the economics of the shutdown, not just debating the wall or not the wall. With me was and is Jeffrey Engel, Director for the Center of Presidential History in Southern Methodist University. Thanks for joining me, Jeff.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And Linda Bilmes, Professor at Harvard's Kennedy School. Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!